Thank you, worship team. You may be seated. I wanted to start a new sermon series with you all today. And the title of it is, What is Right? It's called, What is Right? And I want to ask a question this week, and then spend the next couple of weeks looking at some of the answers. So today's sermon will hopefully make you think. Think about a question, and the question that we're going to look at is we're going to be reading from Judges, going to go through chapters 19 through 21. I'm going to read a few parts of it. And this is kind of an absurd, like, outrageous stories in the Bible, and I'll encourage you to read it. I'm not going to read all of it because it's kind of gruesome this morning, but it's long and it's complicated, but it asks a really important question at the end that I want to look at. And again, we'll kind of look at some of the answers next week. But the book of Judges takes place between the Promised Land and under Joshua's time until King David. So it's about 330 years the book of Judges takes place. And during this time, Israel is a commonwealth. There's no central government. God speaks through judges, and judges rule with God's voice during this time. There was no king. God was the king, and he gave his law, and judges were God's mouthpiece to the nation. So that's where we get the name Judges from, and it talks about the different judges. During this time, there's 12 tribes in Israel. There's Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons, and each of them becomes a tribe of Israel. And they did something, honestly, throughout this whole book, if you read it and study it, they disobey God, disaster comes, and then God delivers them. And it's just this cycle that happens over and over again, that they disobey God, and then disaster becomes of them, and they pray out to God, and God sends a deliverer, and the deliverer, you know, brings them back to God, and they're good for a while, then they disobey God and start this cycle for 330 years over and over again. But at the end of the story, it devolves into this immoral cesspool that is just a crazy story or a few stories kind of put together. But what they did is the tribe, the nation, everyone did what they thought was right in their own eyes. They all do what they think is right, and it's really none of it goes very well. So I want to read to you a few parts of this, but I'll tell some of the story too. We're going to look at a Levite, so from the tribe of Levi. And so this Levite has a concubine, which in Old Testament, it's like a wife, girlfriend, slash maid. And this concubine was from Bethlehem, and she's unfaithful, so she runs back to her father. Eventually, this Levite decides he wants his concubine back, so he travels a long distance to the father's house. And again, I encourage you to read the story. It's just weird. The father keeps getting him drunk and doesn't let him leave. And eventually, halfway, you know, through the day, he gets his concubine, he's got two male servants, some donkeys, and some supplies, and he leaves the father's house with his concubine slash wife in tow to go back to his home country. When they travel, he needs to stop, and his wife, concubine, encourages, let's stop at an Israelite town. It's not safe for us just to stop anywhere. Let's stop at a town for the night that's at least from the tribe of Israel. So they push on, and they end up stopping at this little town called Gibeah, which is a town that the Benjamites, the tribe of Benjamin, his ancestors live in this town. And so they stop in this town, and what they do is you go to the town square, and the law of hospitality would take over. You go to the town square, and you wait for someone to invite you home. And so they go to this town square, and nobody invites them home. Nobody invites them to come home and provide that hospitality until one guy says, what are you doing here? Don't stay in the town. Please come home with me. And he invokes this law of hospitality. Now, it's hard for us to understand this law because we get it. Like, people come over to your house and you're hospitable to them and you feed them. But it was a sacred law in this ancient culture, which was above a lot of things that we would think were more sacred. And so he goes back with them. Now, the Benjamites, they don't like strangers. And probably They don't like strangers because they don't want, they're used to people invading or stealing their wives or children or livestock or grain. But for whatever reason, these Benjamites, some wicked men, get together. They go to this guy's house and they demand that they send out this man and his male servants, and they want to rape them. Like, terrible story. And the tribesmen, I'll read to you starting in 19, we'll start in verse 23. Judges 19:23. The owner of the house went outside and said to them, "No, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this outrageous thing." Now, this guy, he's invoked this law of hospitality. He's going to bring these guys in, and the townsmen want to scare them, and they want word to get out that don't ever go to this town again. Don't ever go to Gibeah. Don't mess with the tribe of Benjamin. And so they kind of have this struggle. Now, the horrible part of the story is eventually this guy who's trying to get back to his hometown, this Levite, he pushes his concubine out the door and shuts the door, and they take this woman and rape her, and she dies. The next morning, he opens the door, and his concubine is dead. Terrible story. And he's outraged by this. He picks up his concubine, puts him on the mule, and they travel back to his hometown. Now, when he gets back to the hometown, he says, you know, he says to himself, I need to write a letter. Like, this is outrageous. How could such a thing happen? Like, yes, they're not from, the Benjamites aren't the same tribe, but we're all the nation of Israel. How could such a horrible thing happen to me? And so he writes this letter to send out to all 12 tribes. And they did something, he realizes, and I think in his own mind, he thinks, they're not going to care. They're going to read this letter and think, yeah, we've heard your sad story, no big deal. So he does something crazy. He takes his poor concubine, and he cuts her up into 12 pieces, and he attaches the letter to a piece of this concubine and sends it to the 12 tribes. Now, when I first was reading through this, I thought, you know, my dad used to read me Bible stories when I was a kid, and never once did he read me the story of the concubine and the chainsaw. Right? Like, you don't read this story to your kids. In Sunday school, we don't teach this story to the kids. But it's the reason, I tell you it for a reason, so bear with me to the end, because it shows what happens when everyone does what they think is right in their own eyes. And so this letter's written, the 12 tribes of Israel get, you know, a piece of this concubine, and this letter, and they're outraged. They're outraged. They all gather together. And in chapter 19, verse 30, this is what happens. It says, "Everyone who saw it was saying to one another, 'Such a thing has never been seen or done, not since the day of the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Just imagine, we must do something. So speak up.'" These 12 tribes get together, the leaders, and they're outraged. They're like, "We've got to do something." So they send out delegates to every city, calling them to arms, calling them to come and send a delegation to discuss what we're going to do. And they make this promise, this decree between all of them, that we will never allow our daughters to marry anyone from the tribe of Benjamin. And they make this promise in God's eyes, like they make a promise before God, we will never allow our children to marry those horrible Benjamites for what they've done. And they make this oath. They put an army together, and they choose. They're like, "Okay, we're going to attack. They first go to this tribe, and they demand that the men who were responsible for this vile act be released to them so they can be put to death." Now, the tribe of Benjamin, they're going to protect their own. They're not going to hand over their own tribesmen, like their own people. And so they say, and they're pretty confident in their warrior skills, and so they say, "No, we're all set." And so the nation of Israel gets together. Now, for perspective, the tribe of Benjamin has about 26,000 soldiers, warriors. But the nation of Israel has over 400,000 soldiers, not including this tribe of Benjamin. So there's a real lopsided, you know, political, powerful might here. But they decide, okay, they drew lots, and they say, "Okay, the tribe of Judah, you're going to go first. You're going to go in, and I want you to get these guys and kill them or bring them back to us, and we're going to put them to death because of what they've done." Now, the tribe of Judah attacks, and that day the Benjamites win, and they kill 22,000 of Judah's soldiers. Like, this is turning into a bloodbath. 22,000 soldiers get killed in day one. Day two, they're like, they come back, they pray, they weep and mourn the death. They're like, they pray, God, what's happening to us? What do we do? And so they decide in day two to send more soldiers in. And the second day, the Benjamites win again, and 18,000 of the Israelite soldiers are killed. Second day. So day three, they pray, God, what are we going to do? Like, this is awful. We need to kill these people. And day three, they send people in, and then they pretend like that they're being defeated and withdraw. And at the same time, another army surrounds and sets the city on fire, and they're caught between. And that day, they kill over 25,000 of Benjamite soldiers. Over 25,000. Their bloodlust is up. And they don't just stop there. They go to town to town, to village to town, and they kill every man, every woman, every child, every animal. They burn the cities to the ground, and they go from town to town, and they kill everybody. Then they give each other a high five, and they go home. Like, we did it. We definitely killed those bad men who threatened this family and who threatened an Israelite, and they go home. Later, they kind of, the bloodlust kind of dies down, and they realize, like, what did we do? Like, we just performed genocide to an entire tribe. Like, it's no longer 12 tribes of Israel. It's going to be 11 tribes of Israel. So they get back together. What are we going to do? We literally just wiped out an entire tribe. And somebody raises their hand and says, well, 600 men did escape. They're hiding in the desert. And they look at each other like, yeah, but they're all males, and we've all made a promise not to let any of our daughters ever marry any of the Benjamites before God, an oath before God. We can't take it back. So what do we do? So again, they think about it. They think, what should we do? And so they come up with this idea. They say, when we sent that decree out to all the cities in Israel, did anybody not respond? Somebody raises their hand and says, well, yeah, there's this one city, Jabesh and Gilead, they didn't respond. And so they get together like, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to send, 10,000 soldiers, and you're going to kill every man, woman, child, and animal in this city. But if there's any virgin daughters, bring them back. So they go, and they do exactly that, and they find 400 women that are virgin of childbearing age. 400, they bring them back. Like, hey, we've got 400, but there's 600 men. So probably they can't just send the 400 and say, okay, draw straws. We got to do something. So again, they have this oath that they can't give their daughters away. So they come up with this second idea. They're like, wait, isn't the Festival of Shiloh coming up in a few weeks? And the Festival of Shiloh is this festival where virgin girls will go into a field and dance. Now, I don't know all of the festival, but it's just part of their coming of age. So they go, they send a delegate to the desert, and they say, hey, we come in peace. We realize we killed all your brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and pets and donkeys and cows and everything you have and burned your houses down. But we have 400 new young wives for you. Come back and repopulate. And then we also have another idea, because I know 200 of you aren't going to have wives and it's not going to work. So Festival of Shiloh is coming out. I want the 200 of you to hide in a field. And when the virgins come out to dance, each of you go kidnap yourself a wife. Then we're not breaking our oath between God, because we didn't give you the daughters. You kidnapped them. So it's fine. They're like, deal. They kidnap the 200 women. The other 400 are given to them. And they each Benjamite throws a woman over his shoulder and goes back to their town, and they repopulate. Case closed. We fixed it. We did everything we could, and we made it work. Now, crazy story, but this is how it ends. Judges 21:25, last verse in Judges. It says this. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes, because there was no authority. There was no law. Yes, there was God's law, but it is easy when we have God's law, it's easy to think, well, I'll follow that tomorrow, or it doesn't really apply to me today. And so they did what they thought was right, and as I thought about it, They did, because they think of the man in Gibeah who wanted to rape and kill these strangers. They were thinking to themselves, we don't like strangers. Strangers are dangerous. We have the right to scare them off. And if we make an example out of this man and it gets around, no one is going to dare come to our town again. We'll be safe. They did what they thought was right. The Levite, he pushed his concubine out the door to these men who gave it up. He thinks in his mind, well, the only reason I'm in this position is because you ran off and your weird father wouldn't let me leave. It's your fault that I'm here. He pushes her out and he thinks, I don't want to die. It's not my fault. Does what he thinks is right. Sacrifices his concubine. Even after she was killed and he wrote that letter to try to get justice, he cut her up because he knew he wouldn't get justice if it wasn't something extraordinarily powerful, a powerful example. So he does what he thinks is right to get justice for someone that he probably cared about. The nation, they're trying to get justice. They're trying to right a wrong. Their hearts were moved. They couldn't believe this could happen to one of their own 12 tribes. Like, we've got to set an example. They did what was right. We demand these people to be released to us so we can put them to death, because this is not right what you allowed to happen to this woman and to this family. And then when the Benjamites, when they hear of it, they do what they think's right. Well, we got to protect our tribe. We can't just hand over, you know, a bunch of people that they think is bad, that we think is trying to stand up for our rights. Like, we can't just hand them over. Like, we're going to have to take them from us. Then the nation of Israel is like, well, we can't let one tribe tell us what to do and decide for their own justice. We're here for justice. We're going to have to reciprocate. We're going to have to, like, put this rebellion down. And then the rebellion explodes in their face, and a bunch of their people get killed, and they wipe out all their people, and they realize we can't allow there only to be 11 tribes of Israel, so we're going to have to find some wives. Where do we find them? We'll kill a bunch of people and steal their daughters, and then we'll, you know, kidnap a few other daughters. Like, everyone did what they thought was right in the story. And so it's radical. It's a crazy story. But I think that it can be our lives as well. That sometimes we can say, I'll do what I think is right in my own eyes. In fact, kind of, it's the American dream, is the freedom to do what we want, where we want, with who we want. It's the American dream that nobody can tell us what to do. And I can do what I want, where I want, with who I want. As long as it's not hurting anybody, then it's my business. That's our culture. We hate being told what to do. That even if it's the right thing, we don't want to be told. In fact, even if it's the right thing, now we feel like we can't do it. We have to do something else because you told me I had to do it. That our culture, that's who we are. That as long as I'm not hurting anyone, I can do whatever I want. But the truth is we can't do whatever we want without hurting someone. That eventually the people closest to you get hurt when you rebel and you do whatever you think is right. And you see this in this story, that a lot of people got hurt. But you can see it in your life. You've probably done something you thought you wasn't going to hurt anybody and you just wanted to do it and you didn't care what other people thought, and then you found out it hurt someone, or someone did something that they didn't think had anything to do with you and it hurt you. And you're like, when we follow our own law and our own moral code, we don't follow the Lord's, we do what we think is right in our own eyes, it does explode in our face. It does make us look back and think, why did I do that? I thought it wouldn't hurt anybody, but it did. And I didn't win. Sometimes we have a choice between aspiring to seeing what we can get away with and putting all of our energy into, like, can I get away with that? Or deciding, what can I really aspire to greatness? Can I aspire to following God and not worrying about, can I get away with this, or if someone told me I have to do it, or if it's right in my eyes or not, but hey, God, this is what you said. This is what's right in your eyes. Can I aspire to following that? And see where it takes us. See how powerful it makes us. Because Jesus has invited us to call him our Heavenly Father. And when we follow God, he does incredible things in our life. But as we see in the entire book of Judges, when we follow our own
ideas. We follow our own, what we think are rights. We usually fail. We fall, we burn out. And then we have to turn back to God and have him deliver us, just like the book cycles over and over again of they disobey God, disaster befalls them, and then he delivers them. If God's looking at our lives and our nation's lives, does that cycle hold true? Do you see that people disobey God? And then sometimes we cry back out and he delivers us. Because I want to avoid the disobeying part so that we can just skip to the being delivered by God part. That we can live our lives and say, I want to avoid those pitfalls, and we do learn in those pitfalls, but I want to just jump to the learning part so I can avoid some storms and some consequences and some traps in my life. I think that's one of the reasons we can read through Judges and say they messed up over and over again. And yes, God was gracious and God came through, but they suffered pretty harshly with the in-betweens. So let us skip the in-betweens and let us be a church and a person, even a nation, that starts to say, no, I'm not going to just do what's right in my own eyes, but I'm going to follow God. And as I close us, think about that question for this week, and we're going to look at some of the answers next week of what happens when a nation or even a person does what they think is right in their own eyes. What happens as that last verse in Judges reads? What happens when they all get together and think, we're going to do what's right in our own eyes because that's going to be the best? Because probably in your life, and I know in my life, it doesn't turn out to be the best. So I'm going to close this in prayer. The worship team, you guys can come up if you want to, because I know we're going to close with a hymn. But as I close in prayer, I also wanted to, quick announcement, I should have done this before the sermon started, but I've been speaking with Ken Roundsville for a few weeks as he's been struggling with I know he's had some prayer requests and been struggling with some health issues. And so he actually told me that he had an appointment this Thursday with his doctors, and he has cancer, and it's come back and it's metastasized. So it's in a lot of different areas, and they're going to kind of talk about, hospice and eventually, and just being supported by friends and family. But we serve a powerful God. So please, he and Gary consider you family. So if you'd pray with him, keep him in your prayers, your thoughts, reach out to him if you feel led to. I'm gonna be calling him this week and just checking in with him. But he's such a great family and been a part of this church for for a long time. So please keep him in prayer. He wanted you guys to know, and so I'm gonna pray for him as well as I close, and then we'll close with a song. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for our church, and I thank you for the Bible and how incredible that the book of Judges can speak to us and warn us so many years later. And Lord, I pray that you'd give us strength to look at our lives and realize that it's not about what I can get away with. It's about the moral ideology that following you is what I want, Lord. Following you helps me to avoid so many pitfalls. And Lord, when people do what they think is right in their own eyes, it ends in disaster. Let us always let you take the reins, take the wheel, be our saviors, drive our lives, Lord, because we know following you is where you set us to be, to run a race with perseverance, where you set us to run a race that we can win. Lord, help us to keep you as our focal point. And also, Lord, I pray you be with Ken, Gary, Ken's wife, their family, Lord. Help them to know you so powerfully, Lord, as you've blessed him with a good life and a good family and a good church family. Lord, help us to surround him, touch his body, give him the strength he needs. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us as a church to know how to support him, how to just show him your love and grace during this difficult time. In Jesus' precious name we pray. Amen. Thank you.